United States District Court for the Northern District of Illinois Eastern Division, is housed in the Federal Building in Chicago's Loop. It's plain black steel and glass stretching 30 stories into the sky. On the 23rd floor, hundreds of prospective jurors sit in silence as a judge addresses the room. It's jury selection time for the Chicago 8, and things are not going well for the defense. Those accused are charged with conspiring to cross state lines to incite a riot, with teaching the making of incendiary devices, with committing acts to impede law enforcement officers in their lawful duties. Objection. Is it possible to recite the charges in a less dramatic fashion? Your Honor sounds like Orson Welles reading the Declaration of Independence. Overruled. May I proceed, Mr. Kunstler?
Lead defense attorney William Kunstler sits down, dejected.
Yes, Your Honor. Now, where were we? Ms. Peterson, what is your current marital status? I'm married, Your Honor.
Kunstler turns to his co-counsel, Leonard Weinglass.
Now he's ignoring all our questions. On purpose.
He is Judge Julius Hoffman. He's a 74-year-old Republican, and he prides himself on quick and efficient jury selection. But Kunstler wants these jurors to answer real questions. Like, do you have any hostile feelings towards persons whose lifestyle differ considerably from your own? Do you know who Jefferson Airplane, Country Joe and the Fish, Phil Oaks, or the Fugs are? Do you consider marijuana habit forming? In other words, how likely are you to be biased against the 8 counterculture radicals about to go on trial? But the judge isn't having it. Normally, for such a high-profile case, the court would spend several days carefully selecting 12 jurors and 2 alternates.
Next, your age? 21, Your Honor. Thank you. That'll be all.
Judge Hoffman gets the job done in one day.
You're dismissed.
When it's over, defense co-counsel Leonard Weinglass stares at the jury in disbelief.
10 women, 2 men, mostly middle-aged? Jesus Christ.
Typically, Bill Kunstler has a lot more faith in the system than his clients do. He voted for Democrat Hubert Humphrey a few months ago in the contentious 1968 presidential election. When he walks into a courtroom, he believes in the blindfolded lady with the scales. But now, Kunstler's faith is getting a serious test, and the trial hasn't even started. He glances over at his clients, turns to Weinglass, and drops his voice.
Down south, they have a term for a judge like this.
Oh, what's that?
A hanging judge.
American History Tellers is sponsored by Audible. I like puzzles. I like adventure. I like clever people. I like things on the edge, which means I love mysteries, the perfect combination of storytelling, mental challenge, and often murder, like in the Penguin modern classic, Perfume, The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind. And as an Audible member, I can choose one title every month to keep forever from the entire catalog of classics, bestsellers, new releases, and Audible originals, ready to listen whenever, wherever, on the Audible app. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/tellers or text tellers to 500-500. That's audible.com/tellers or text tellers to 500-500.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American History Tellers. Our history, your story. This is episode 2 of our special series on the trial of the Chicago 8. We're telling the story in collaboration with another Wondery podcast, Legal Wars. Hill Harper, who hosts that show and who you just heard, will be taking us through the drama in the courtroom. The trial captured the nation's attention, even in the midst of almost unprecedented political turmoil. Things had come to a head in August of 1968 when riots consumed the city of Chicago during the week of the Democratic National Convention. Thousands gathered to protest U.S. action in Vietnam, and the cops cracked down. It was war in the streets. The federal government blamed the protesters and brought charges against 8 prominent activists. But the trial was about more than just who threw the first punch. During the trial, the radicals and establishment interrogated each other relentlessly. On one side, the 8 liberal defendants, Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Bobby Seale, Dave Dellinger, Rennie Davis, Tom Hayden, John Froines, and Lee Weiner. On the other side, representing the U.S. government, Judge Julius Hoffman and the sitting mayor of Chicago, Richard J. Daley. It was a battle for the soul of American culture, and both sides planned to win by any means necessary.
On the first day of the trial, spectators hoping to glimpse the action line up around the block starting at the crack of dawn. It's early fall, but already freezing in Chicago. Strong winds blowing off Lake Michigan can chill you to the bone. Local news crews, film cameras at the ready, huddle in vans, ready to jump out when the defendants arrive. The police, as always, are on hand in case there's trouble. One by one, the defendants enter the courtroom, and almost immediately, the theatrics begin.
The jury will please disregard the kiss blown by Defendant Hayden.
The defendants are charged with conspiracy to travel interstate with the intent to incite, organize, promote, encourage, participate in, and carry out a riot. John Froines and Lee Weiner are charged with teaching others how to make incendiary devices. And the other 6, Hoffman, Rubin, Seale, Hayden, Dellinger, and Davis, are charged with inciting violence. Added up, each defendant faces 10 years behind bars. The prim, proper, and perpetually outraged Assistant U.S. Attorney Richard Schultz is here to remind the jury why.
The government, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, will prove in this case the case which you will witness as jurors, an overall plan of the 8 defendants in this case, which was to encourage numerous people to come to the city of Chicago. People who planned legitimate protest during the Democratic National Convention, which was held in Chicago in August of 1968, from August 26th through August 29th, 1968. They planned to bring these people into Chicago to protest, legitimately protest, as I said, creating a situation in this city where these people would come to Chicago, would riot. The defendants, in perpetrating this offense, the defendants, crossed state lines themselves.
Defendant Tom Hayden is a pretty brilliant man, but even he is having trouble following this meandering opening statement. He looks over at the jury. They seem as bored as he feels. Hayden notices several of the jurors looking back in his direction. Schultz, now naming the defendants, says Tom Hayden. Hayden cheerily salutes the jurors with a raised fist. Judge Hoffman immediately cuts the prosecutor off.
Mr. Marshall, please excuse the jury from the courtroom.
The jurors leave. Hoffman continues and addresses Schultz.
Who is the last defendant you named, Mr. Hayden? The one that shook his fist in the direction of the jury? That is my customary greeting, Your Honor. It may be your customary greeting, but we do not allow shaking of fists in this courtroom. I made that clear. It implied no disrespect for the jury. It is my customary greeting. Regardless of what it implies, sir, there will be no fist shaking, and I caution you not to repeat it.
With Hayden cautioned and the jury brought back in, Schultz continues to state the government's case against the defendants. He outlines a 3-step plan these alleged conspirators employed to invite protesters to Chicago with the explicit goal of sparking a violent, large-scale confrontation.
In sum, then, ladies and gentlemen, The government will prove that the eight defendants charged here conspired together to use interstate commerce and the facilities of interstate commerce to incite and to further a riot in Chicago.
It's now defense attorney William Kunstler's turn to speak, and he has one central point to make. He readily agrees that there was a conspiracy, but from his point of view, this conspiracy wasn't hatched by his clients sitting in some dark, shadowy basement somewhere, plotting to ensure the streets of Chicago ran red with blood. No, instead, he points the finger in a different direction, which raises the stakes.
The real conspiracy was against these defendants. But we are going to show that the real conspiracy is not against these defendants as individuals because they are unimportant as individuals. The real attempt was, the real attack was on the rights of everybody. All of us American citizens, all to protest under the First Amendment to the Constitution.
Kunstler is pleased with what feels like a solid and well-put opening statement. But when he sits back down, he can see that his clients are furious. During a recess, they let their lead attorney have it.
What the hell are you thinking? That was your opening statement? This was our chance to tell them why we're really here, what we're really fighting for.
Calm down, Abby.
You blew it, Bill. Can't even believe this. Tom, can you?
It's not about our rights. It's not about the First Amendment. We don't care about any of that. What we care about is the soldiers dying in Vietnam. I thought you understood.
It's decided Leonard Wineglass will make these points when the defendants return to court. But he can't. Every time he mentions Vietnam, Judge Hoffman tells him not to talk about anti-war positions. Finally, Judge Hoffman yells at him.
Mr. Wineglass, I think your persistency in disregarding the direction of the court and the law in the face of repeated admonitions is contumacious conduct, and I so find it on the record.
He's accusing Wineglass of outright disrespect and refusing to obey the judge's authority. That's going to be a theme throughout the trial. Opening statements complete, more or less. The fundamental question is established. Are these eight men, often profane, often theatrical, always outspoken in their criticism of America, a sinister cabal? Did they advocate for violence in Chicago and get exactly what they were hoping for? Or are they well-intentioned idealists, unjustly facing punishment from a duplicitous federal government trying to squash dissent? Just who are the Chicago Eight? Judge Hoffman has forbidden cameras in the courtroom, so magazines, newspapers, and TV networks send sketch artists to depict the drama as it unfolds on day one. Cartoonist Jules Pfeiffer captures Judge Hoffman resting his head against his right hand in a pose of wearied agitation. Part of what he finds so irritating about these radicals is that they're radical in different ways. The Eight have recognized this from the beginning. It's the government that decided to try them as a group, forcing them to appear in court together like some sort of protest super team. Is there mutual respect between them? Sure. But Tom thinks Abby and Jerry waste time with their endless clowning. Abby and Jerry think Tom is square and uptight. Dave Dellinger believes there's no excuse for violence for any reason, ever. Bobby Seale is a Black Panther who believes in the right to armed self-defense. Weiner and Freund are aspiring professors. When Abby Hoffman thinks about it all, he just has to laugh. These guys in a conspiracy? Hell, they can't even agree on lunch. But Judge Hoffman is not laughing. He sees a group of defendants and their lawyers clearly scheming to undermine his court.
I want to make a statement. Just a minute, sir. Who is your lawyer?
Bobby Seale looks directly at the judge.
Charles R. Gary.
As Judge Hoffman knows, along with everyone else, Charles R. Gary is not in this courtroom. Hoffman asks the jury to leave the courtroom for the third time today. It's only 11 o'clock. Maybe you've forgotten. So much has happened already.
Charles R. Gary is Bobby Seale's lawyer, but he isn't in the courtroom because he's at home in California recovering from gallbladder surgery. Seale tells the judge he doesn't want Kunstler or Leonard Weinglass to represent him. He wants Gary. Gary asked Hoffman to postpone the trial for 6 weeks while he regained his health, but the judge refused. William Kunstler gets up and tells Judge Hoffman that to make an opening statement on Bobby Seale's behalf will compromise his client's position, that the trial can't go forward until he has the lawyer he wants. Judge Hoffman replies,
I don't ask you to compromise it, sir, but I will not permit him to address the jury with his very competent lawyer seated there. If I were to make an opening statement, I would compromise his position that he is not his full counsel here. Mr. Seale, you are not to make an opening statement. I so order you. You are not permitted to in the circumstances of this case.
With that, Judge Hoffman asks the prosecution to call their first witness. Raymond Simon, corporation counsel for Chicago and the city's top attorney, takes the stand. He's up there because Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin approached him on August 8, 1968, requesting a permit for protesters to congregate in Lincoln Park the week of the Democratic National Convention. Simon turned them down. Rennie Davis and others from the National Mobilization Committee to End the War in Vietnam sued, and Simon met with them, he says, to try and find a solution. Prosecutor Thomas Foran addresses Simon.
What did Mr. Davis say? He said, if the city doesn't give us the park, there will be tens of thousands of people without a place to stay, and they will go into the parks, and the police will drive them out, and they will run through the streets of the city, and there will be disorder and conflict and problems, and the police will fight back, and there will be tear gas and mace and billy clubs.
Davis didn't get what he wanted. His lawsuit against the city of Chicago was dismissed, meaning that if he and his protesters wanted to demonstrate in Lincoln Park, they'd have to do so without a permit. The world saw what happened next: tear gas, mace, and billy clubs. This begs the question, was Rennie Davis, clearly a leader, just being irresponsible when he decided to go ahead with the rally, knowing what could happen? Or, as the prosecution is clearly suggesting, was violence the goal all along? September 30th, day 5. Tensions ratchet up a notch. Prosecuting attorney Thomas Foran addresses the court.
I was informed just about the time we were to come to court by the FBI that they had been informed that one of the jurors had received a letter, or her family had received a letter that certainly could be of a threatening nature. It is addressed to the King family, 81 South Caroline, Crystal Lake, Illinois, 60014. It is written in script, "You are being watched. The Black Panthers."
Bobby Seale, quaking with rage, whispers to his co-defendants,
"That's a forgery. We never sign anything the Black Panthers. It's always the Black Panther Party, or if we're being formal, the Black Panther Party for self-defense."
There are actually two letters, both sent to Christy King. She's young, and through her sister, has a connection to the Peace Corps. The defense sees these two points as being in their favor. They could also explain why someone working against them would want to frighten King off the jury. Defense attorney Kunstler, like Seale, knows the letters are bogus and tells the judge so.
We are at the point, Your Honor, where the defendants have seriously made a statement that they believe that the two letters in question were sent in some way by some agent of the government in order to prejudice them further in this trial. That is their position. I think they have publicly stated it, and that is the position which they take.
Judge Hoffman scoffs. He sits elevated 10 feet above the floor. Behind him hang several framed portraits of the Founding Fathers. Hoffman is certain those great men would be rolling in their graves if they could hear what was just said.
He squints down at the defense table.
I will let you try to prove that right now. That is a very grave charge against an office of the government. Well, we obviously can't prove it, Your Honor. Then don't say it. This is the client's position. That is my statement. To make a statement like that is irresponsible.
It's clear Christy King is already badly rattled. Now she's under Judge Hoffman's microscope. He says to the young woman,
Have you seen either of these letters?
No, Your Honor.
Well, then, you'd better just take this right now and read it.
Christy does as instructed.
Now knowing how you and your family have been threatened, do you believe you still would be able to remain impartial in this case?
Christy King's face reddens. She looks quickly at Bobby Seale, then away. Quietly, she replies,
No.
Miss King, your services are no longer required in this trial. You are dismissed.
King's replacement is a woman named Kay Richards, who just happens to be engaged to Mayor Richard Daley's supervisor of personnel. Judge Hoffman does not see a conflict of interest. Over the next month, the prosecution calls witness after witness, all of whom testify about their certainty that the defendants intended violence. One is Robert Pearson, a police officer who went undercover in order to get dirt on Abby Hoffman. He explains how for his assignment, he altered his appearance to come across a little less cop-like and more like a radical.
I allowed my hair to grow long. I allowed myself to go without a shave for approximately 4 to 6 weeks. I purchased the attire of a motorcycle gang member, which is motorcycle boots, a black t-shirt, black Levi's, and a black leather vest, and a motorcycle helmet. Monday, August 26, 1968, did you have any occasion on that day to go to Lincoln Park? Yes, sir, I did. Jordan introduced me to Abby Hoffman. He said, Abby, this is Bob. He will be one of your bodyguards. I said to Hoffman that last night's confrontation was a pretty good one. And Hoffman said to me that last night they pushed us out of the park, but tonight we're going to hold the park. He then said that, We're going to. And he used a foul word. F up the pigs and the convention. What was the word, please? Will you relate it? Fuck.
As the first month wraps up, a separate and ongoing issue reasserts itself. Since the opening statement debacle, Judge Hoffman and Bobby Seale have barely been able to exchange three civil words. On Monday, October 27th, day 34 of the trial, the situation escalates. Seale again tells Judge Hoffman that he wants his lawyer.
What about my constitutional right to defend myself and have my lawyer? Your constitutional rights? You are denying them. You have been denying them. Every other word you say is denied, 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 and you begin to oink in the face of the masses of the people of this country. That is what you begin to represent? The corruptness of this rotten government of 400 years? Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I regret that I will have to excuse you. I hope you don't blame me for anything. And those false, lying notes and letters that were sent that said the Black Panther Party threatened the jury, it's a lie. And you know it's a lie. And the government did it to taint the jury against me.
Over the next couple days, things between Bobby Seale and Judge Hoffman get even more intense.
I am warning you, sir, that the law...
Instead of warning, why don't you warn me I've got a right to defend myself, huh?
I am warning you that the court has the right to gag you. I don't want to do that. Under the law, you may be gagged and chained to your chair.
Gagged? I am being railroaded already.
The court has the right and
I... The court has no right whatsoever. The court has no right to stop me from speaking out in my behalf of my constitutional rights.
The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Everyone will please rise.
I am not rising. I am not rising until he recognizes my constitutional rights.
Mr. Marshall, see that he rises. Mr. Seale, and the other one too. Get all the defendants to rise. Mr. Hayden, will you please rise? Let the record show that none of the defendants has risen. The court will be in recess.
The following day,
October 29th, Abby Hoffman makes an observation.
There are 25 marshals in here now, and they all got guns.
It's clear that the marshals are here in force and armed for one purpose: to keep Bobby Seale and his supporters in the courtroom in check. It's a startling image in a trial already filled with them. And it's not going to be the craziest thing these people see.
American History Tellers is sponsored by ZBiotics. Last week, I went to a big podcast conference with tons of meetings and a lot of happy hours. So the nights were late and the drinks were many. Sometimes you need to choose between a fun evening and a good morning. Or maybe not, if I had just remembered to pack my ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink, the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. Invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking, it creates an enzyme that breaks down a toxic byproduct produced in the gut when you drink alcohol. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. You just need to remember to make ZBiotics your first drink of the night, drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow. I wish I did. Vacations, weddings, birthdays, and reunions, there's so much going on, so get the most out of your spring plans by stocking up on pre-alcohol now. Go to ZBiotics.com/tellers to get 15% off your first order when you use tellers at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/tellers and use the code tellers at checkout for 15% off.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral Way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
Bobby Seale was born on October 22nd, 1936 in Dallas, Texas, the oldest of three children. His father, a carpenter, struggled to make ends meet, and when Bobby was eight, the family left Texas for California, seeking a better life. The Seals were just a few of the millions of African Americans who left the South as part of the Great Migration. They wound up in Oakland, joining the growing Black community there. At 18, Seale dropped out of high school and enlisted in the Air Force. He lasted 3 years until he got kicked out for fighting a commanding officer. Seale was court-martialed, then dishonorably discharged. He was told he had just 5 minutes to get off the base. He replied, "What are you going to do with the other 4 minutes and 59 seconds? Because it won't take me any time to get away from here." Seale returned to Oakland, where he worked in a sheet metal factory by day and finished his high school degree at night. Seale sought to continue his education at Oakland's Merritt College, a seemingly ordinary decision that would have a major impact on the civil rights movement. In the early 1960s, at Merritt College, Seale stood out. He was outspoken, political, and anti-authority. He immersed himself in Black nationalist literature, studying the teachings of Malcolm X, and joined the Afro-American Association. One day, during a rally in West Oakland, Seale came across another young Black man making a name for himself on campus, speaking to a riveted group of about 250 students about the Cuban Missile Crisis. His name was Huey P. Newton. Newton was born in 1942, the seventh son of a Louisiana sharecropper and Baptist preacher. He was named after Huey P. Long, the populist Louisiana governor assassinated in 1935. The Newtons, like the Seals, wound up in Oakland as part of the Great Migration. There, Newton and Seale shared a mutual respect and bonded over their commitment to radical Black activism. They fought to get Black studies and other Afrocentric courses added to the Merritt College curriculum. And on October 15th, 1966, they founded the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. The previous year had been difficult for those in the civil rights struggle. Malcolm X had been assassinated on February 21, 1965, shot 21 times while addressing an audience in Manhattan. The following month, Bloody Sunday occurred in Alabama. Hundreds of protesters marching from Selma to Montgomery were attacked at the Edmund Pettus Bridge by state troopers who beat them with nightsticks and sprayed them with tear gas. Though a major victory came with the Voting Rights Act of 1965, just days after it was signed into law, riots erupted in Watts, a black community in Los Angeles, in response to news of a violent traffic stop in which a white officer kicked a pregnant black woman. The riot lasted for 6 days, caused millions of dollars in damage, and resulted in 34 deaths. But for Seal and Newton, it was an event of the next year, 1966, that was likely the last straw. Matthew Johnson, an unarmed black man, had been shot to death by police in nearby San Francisco. Seal and Newton felt that this incident further proved that black people couldn't expect protection by the police. If anything, black citizens needed protection from the police, and the Black Panthers were formed a month later. The symbol for the party, the image of a crouched and snarling Black Panther, was borrowed from the Lowndes County Freedom Organization in Alabama. The Panther leaders felt the symbol neatly summed up their philosophy. As Newton put it, "It's not in the Panther's nature to attack first, but when he is attacked and backed into a corner, he will respond viciously." Seal and Newton drafted a 10-point platforming outlining the party's beliefs and demands, including an emphasis on self-defense. To raise money for guns and ammunition, they sold copies of Chairman Mao's Little Red Book on college campuses. The Panthers felt it was critical to keep an eye on the police. While the cops patrolled Oakland, the Panthers patrolled the cops. Newton and Seal saw to it that the Panthers acted as a deterrent to police brutality in the East Bay. The party gained national prominence in May of the next year, 1967, when 30 armed Panthers arrived at the Capitol building in Sacramento to protest the signing of the Mulford Act, a bill that prohibited the carrying of firearms in public. The Panthers tried to enter the assembly, but were denied access. Some members, including Seal, were arrested and charged with disrupting a legislative session. Upon release, Seal stood in front of the police station and issued a forceful statement. "The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense calls upon the American people in general, and the black people in particular, to take careful note of the racist California legislature, which is considering legislation aimed at keeping the black people disarmed and powerless at the very same time that racist police agencies throughout the country are intensifying the terror, brutality, murder, and repression of black people." The way the Panthers saw it, guns were essential for protection in their environment. After all, the cops were armed, and always would be. The Panthers maintained the goal was an end to violence, but were adamant on how it should be done. They stated, "We are advocates of the abolition of war, which can only be abolished through war, and in order to get rid of the gun, it is necessary to pick up the gun." This was not Dr. King's brand of activism. The Panthers were much closer to Malcolm X's more confrontational philosophy. Channeling Malcolm, Newton promised, "We will change society. We will use whatever means are necessary. We will have our manhood, even if we have to level the earth." Yet another aspect of the Panthers that made them distinct was their emphasis on Marxist-Leninist ideology. They were concerned that the legal and political advancements King was fighting for would only benefit middle-class blacks. They felt working-class people, from which Seal and Newton came, would be left behind. The last of their 10-point platform stated, "We want land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, and peace." They also pioneered direct social service programs in local neighborhoods, including a free breakfast program for children and medical clinics for the needy. But it was their militancy that drew most of the attention. The Panthers clashed often with the police. On October 28, 1967, a shootout between the police and the Panthers left one officer dead, another in serious condition, and Newton with a bullet in the stomach. He was arrested, handcuffed in the hospital while receiving treatment. Newton did 33 months behind bars. Throughout that time, his fellow Panthers held frequent Free Huey rallies. In 1968, there was another high-profile altercation with the cops. One Panther was killed, and Eldridge Cleaver was wounded.
Cleaver gained fame for his memoir written in prison, Soul on Ice, and he had taken a larger role in the Panthers after Newton's arrest. Over the next year and a half, the Panthers would tangle with the police nearly a dozen more times. New chapters were opening across the nation, and public officials took notice. They feared the spread of lawlessness and a rising tide of black radicalism. One of the most worried was FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. He called the Panthers the greatest threat to the internal security of the country. As early as May of 1967, there were police raids on Panther Party offices. By August, the FBI's operation, called COINTELPRO, was at work with the mission of preventing a coalition of militant black nationalist groups. The same FBI program was also spying on other prominent black leaders, including Martin Luther King Jr. The Bureau went to great lengths to interfere with unification efforts amongst black groups. Hoover's greatest fear, it seems, was a black messiah who would bring all the groups together and topple society. To keep such a figure from rising, the FBI employed informants, spread misinformation, and helped the police in their raids. The most infamous of these raids took place on December 4, 1969, in Chicago. The police targeted an apartment rented by Fred Hampton, a Black Panther swiftly moving up the ranks in the party. Hampton had done an effective job uniting groups within Chicago and had been recently promoted to the Panther Central Committee. But FBI informant William O'Neill told officials that Hampton's West Monroe Street apartment was being used to stockpile weapons. In the hours before dawn, the police descended upon Hampton, his 9-month pregnant fiance, and several members of the party as they slept. Panther Mark Clark was on guard that night and sat in the front room of the apartment with a shotgun at the ready. When the police kicked down the door, they fired on Clark and killed him. As he took a fatal hit to the chest, Clark reflexively fired back. It was to be the only round fired by a Panther that morning. The police stormed into the room where Hampton and his fiancée lay sleeping. But Hampton did not wake during the raid because hours earlier, William O'Neill, the FBI informant, drugged him by slipping a barbiturate in his drink. The police checked Hampton's vitals and discovered that he was wounded but not dead. So they shot him twice in the head, dragged his body into the hallway, and left him there. Then they fired into yet another room. The Panthers they found there were wounded, then beaten, then arrested, and ultimately indicted by a grand jury on charges of weapons possession, armed violence, and attempted murder. In total, the police fired 99 shots. The Panthers only shot once, and that was Mark Clark's involuntary pull of the trigger as he was killed. Nevertheless, the police described the raid as a shootout. Not long after the raid, there was a break-in at the FBI field office in Pennsylvania. COINTELPRO documents were discovered. These documents revealed a floor plan of Hampton's apartment and a plan to conceal the FBI's role in his assassination. This prompted a lengthy legal battle, and in 1982, 13 years after the raid, the federal government and Cook County settled with the survivors of the raid and Hampton's relatives for $1.85 million, or almost $5 million today. By 1970, 28 Black Panthers had been killed, while 2,000 more were arrested. The 70s would prove to be hard years for the party. As always, law enforcement threatened it from the outside, but there were also cracks of internal division. Panthers disagreed with each other on the path forward. There was grave suspicion of informants. There was also a leadership crisis, as top officers faced legal cases and prison time. Newton would stay in jail until 1970, Cleaver jumped bail in 68 and then fled to Cuba. And of course, there was Bobby Seale, who in 1969 faced trial in Chicago alongside the 7 other defendants. Seale brought his experience with the Black Panthers into the courtroom. And whether on the streets, in prison, or in court, Seale would fearlessly take on anyone who stood in his way, even if it meant paying a high price.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well, inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
It's day 36 of the trial, and Bobby Seale and Judge Julius Hoffman are still arguing. The jury is once again asked to leave the courtroom.
Mr. Seale, I have admonished you previously. I have a right to cross-examine the witness. What might happen to you if you keep on talking? We are going to recess now, young man. If you keep this up... Look, old man, if you keep up denying me my constitutional rights, you are being exposed to the public and the world that you do not care about people's constitutional rights to defend themselves.
Judge Hoffman reiterates his threat from the previous day.
I will tell you that what I indicated yesterday might happen to you...
Happen to me? What could happen to me more than what Benjamin Franklin and George Washington did to black people in slavery? What can happen to me more than that?
Mr. Seale, do you want to stop or do you want me to direct the marshal?
I want to argue the point.
We will take a recess. Take the defendant into the room there and deal with him as he should be dealt with. I still want to be represented. I want to represent myself.
The marshal turns to the nearest defense attorney.
William Kunstler, will you instruct the defendants, sir, that it is the order of the court that they will rise upon the recess?
If that is a direction of the court, I certainly will pass it on. Let the record show none of the defendants have stood at this recess in response to the marshal's request.
Let the record show.
He's cut off. Six marshals rush in and grab Bobby Seale. The other seven defendants jump to their feet, and Dave Dellinger, the pacifist, tries to get between Seale and the marshals. He's thrown to the floor. Yippee co-founder Jerry Rubin yells for all to hear.
They're kicking him in the balls.
A marshal punches him in the face. Tom Hayden shouts above the melee.
Your Honor, all he wants is to be legally represented, not be a slave here.
The chaos of the Chicago streets is now in the courtroom.
Get off me, goddamn pigs. Get the hell off me.
The marshals drag Bobby into a back room. Bobby Seale's ankles and wrists are put in chains.
Hey, get off me! Get off me!
The marshals tie a thick white cloth around the back of his head and over his mouth. And then this is followed by perhaps the most shocking moment of all. He's brought back in, and the judge and marshals attempt to resume the trial as if nothing happened.
Mr. Foran, would you like to proceed?
This is a true turning point. William Kunstler can't contain himself.
I wanted to say the record should indicate that Mr. Seale is seated on a metal chair. Each hand is handcuffed to the leg of the chair on both the right and left sides so he cannot raise his hands. And a gag is tightly pressed into his mouth and tied at the rear, and that when he attempts to speak, a muffled sound comes out as he has done several times since he has been bound and gagged.
Bobby Seale has been muzzled, but not silenced.
Mr. Marshall, I don't think you've accomplished your purpose.
Judge Hoffman orders yet another recess, and the marshals carry Seale out once again, still chained to his chair. When he's brought back in, there's a plug-like device in his mouth. Same story the next day. Seale sits in the courtroom, plugged and in chains. Once again, he struggles against the marshals, and a chair is kicked over. At this point, pandemonium breaks out again. Marshals elbow and punch defendants, spectators, and journalists. The court's sketch artist gets it all. William Kunstler has never witnessed anything like this, and it's making him more of a radical by the second.
This is no longer a court of order, Your Honor. This is a medieval torture chamber. It is a disgrace. They are assaulting the other defendants also.
Yet again, the whole world is watching. And the viewers at home have seen the hand-drawn images of the black man in chains on the front page of the morning papers. This is very bad publicity. Eventually, Seal is allowed to appear in court without the restraints. The increasingly cranky judge peers down at the lead defense attorney. Bill H. Ray, San Mateo County Deputy Sheriff, is on the witness stand.
Mr. Kunstler, do you have any cross-examination of this witness? Your Honor, since this witness only related facts relevant to Mr. Seal, who has, as Your Honor knows, discharged me, I have no questions. I think I have a right to cross-examine. Mr. Seal, I ask you to sit down.
Bobby Seal is clearly not the kind of guy who sits down when he's told to sit down. He has some questions for the man testifying against him.
Have you ever killed a Black Panther Party member? Mr. Seal, I will have to ask you to sit down, please. Have you ever been on any raids in the Black Panther Party's offices or Black Panther Party members' homes? Mr. Seal, this is the third time I'm asking you to sit down as courteously as possible.
Judge Hoffman has the jury leave the courtroom.
You are making it very difficult for me, Mr. Seal. You are making it very difficult for me, Judge Hoffman.
Judge Hoffman seems to be building to something. Len Wineglass knows what's coming next and isn't surprised when Hoffman says,
I find the acts, statements, and conduct of the defendant Bobby Seal constitute a deliberate and willful attack upon the administration of justice, an attempt to sabotage the functioning of the federal judiciary system, and misconduct of so grave a character as to make the mere imposition of a fine a futile gesture and a wholly insignificant punishment.
Judge Hoffman then sentences Bobby Seal to contempt, citing some 16 instances of it. Penalty? 4 years behind bars. But there's more.
There will be an order declaring a mistrial as to the defendant Bobby G. Seal and not as to any other defendants.
The marshals return, this time to take Bobby Seal back to prison. As he is dragged away and spectators shout,
Free Bobby!
Seal makes sure he's heard.
Wait a minute, I got a right. What's the cat trying to pull now? I can't stay? I still want an immediate trial. You can't call it a mistrial. I'm put in jail for 4 years for nothing? Hey, I want my coat.
The date is November 5th, 1969. The Chicago 8 are now the Chicago 7. For Bobby Seal, this part is over. But for Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Tom Hayden, Dave Dellinger, Rennie Davis, Lee Weiner, and John Freund, it's just the beginning.
Next week, on the third episode of this special American History Tellers and Legal War series on the trial of the Chicago 8, the defendants step up their defiance of the court and call a who's who of legendary 60s celebrities, philosophers, and activists to help them do it. I hope you enjoyed this episode. American History Tellers is hosted, edited, and produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Sound designed by Spoke and Derek Behrens. This episode was co-hosted by Hill Harper. Our writer is Hannibal Diaz. Our legal consultant is Katie Berger Kramer. And our researchers are Caitlin Crammon and Dan Wallace. Editors are Casey Miner and Dorian Marina. This episode was produced by Stephanie Jens, George Lavender, Jenny Lauer-Beckman, and Katie Long. Our executive producers are Marshall Louis and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
I love a good parasocial relationship with a celebrity who will probably never know my name.
I mean, honestly, who knows? Don't count yourself out. But my favorite part about these feuds is how they're ignited by the tiniest things.
Jada, I love you. G.I. Jane 2, can't wait to see it.
I accidentally laminated my brows too much.
It starts small and then it gets so big.
To be honest, Naomi, I'm fearful of you to this day.
I don't know her.
We all just have to admit, we're addicted. Everybody has opinions. Everyone picks sides.
Leave Britney Spears alone right now.
From Wondery, I'm Sydney Battle.
And I'm Matt Bellassai.
And this is Dis and Tell, la, 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 where we unpack why we get so invested in these feuds and whether or not our attention only makes the whole thing worse.
Follow Dis and Tell wherever you get your podcasts.